Well, the piece of wreckage that you're talking about that Marcel Vogel had was given to him by Billy Meyer, the police, the account that I have read. That was a piece of material that Billy Meyer gave from Switzerland. And Vogel also had perhaps other pieces from other either wreckage or remnants or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And the pieces did somehow disappear. We talked at great length.
But here now, if they've never been recovered again, they've never surfaced.
Well, but see, there's more of them available, and Marcel Vogel knows that.
Mm-hmm.
There's
mm-hmm.
more pieces available, and
is he still alive today?
Don't know.
He's not.
I don't know.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. But we have covered the Roswell case at great length, and we talk about that from time to time with various people in the UFO community. We got involved in investigations into UFOs rather heavily about a year ago
mm-hmm.
on this program, and we broke a number of stories nationwide, including Lazar and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
The most interesting thing that has occurred is that a very prominent publisher, which is Simon & Schuster, is publishing Howard Bloom's book Out There, which is a good wrap-up with some new information about the UFO mysteries, and that has tremendously legitimatized it because Howard Bloom is the same guy that did the John Walker story, the spy, okay? So there's a lot coming down the pike, Carol. You should just stay with us and listen.
And in a few days, at the NASA presentation at the Lewis Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio, which is NASA's Energy and Power Development Center,
okay,
I am going to throw down the gauntlet. I am going to present videotapes, which I have been previewing the last two or three days, of these devices in operation. And I am going to present the proposal that the engineers at NASA bring these scientists, these inventors who have created these devices, into the NASA labs and test them, because in those devices is the answer not just to the global energy problem, but to the individual problem, where it hits the road, where it meets people.
Well, give us, we have a minute before break, but give us an idea, give us a capsule of what kind of devices are you talking about? Are you talking about a light bulb that lights all by itself, or what?
Yep. We're basically talking devices that reach into space, space-time, and convert direct electrical energy from the basic properties of the space-time continuum. Now,
I'm talking about the scientists who duplicated the Ark of the Covenant, and they had to destroy it because it put out too much energy.
Now what this is...
All right, hang on. Let's do the break, and we'll come right back. I'm all ears. I want to hear about this.
Well, for 10 or 20 years, there have been a series of very serious people, sort of homegrown Thomas Alva Edisons, and they range in skills from your backyard inventor type all the way up to the man that we're going to talk a great deal about in the show today, Dr. Bruce De Palma, who was a Harvard MIT physicist, taught physics at MIT, realized about 10, 15 years ago that the physics he was teaching didn't work, that there were some fundamental flaws in the theoretical underpinnings. He quit, and he went into basically designing experiments that would prove where the gaps were and where to bridge the gaps and what might happen if you did bridge those gaps. That has brought him, over the last 10, 15 years, to the creation of a series of working technologies, working devices. I've been watching the videotapes. I've got to say, open mouth at what I have seen. And these devices create energy, apparently, out of thin air. They create more energy coming out the front end than goes in the back end to get them up to speed to make them work. They're called greater-than-unity energy machines. And by everything we think we know in the physics that you're taught in high school or at MIT, they should not work. Problem is, everything we think we know is not true. And that's where the Mars work comes in. Because totally separate, I mean, Bruce De Palma and I had never even met until 2 days ago when we got together on the phone. Our Mars work, for the last 7, 8 years, trying to decode this set of enigmatic objects on the surface of the planet Mars, has been focusing more and more on the fact that there was a demonstrable message, a set of equations left to us in these large geometric shaped and arranged structures. When we decoded the message, when we had the major breakthrough in this research this spring, we realized that fundamentally what that message was telling us was a way to extract energy from nothing, from the universe. That's when I went on the trail looking to see if these little devices I'd heard about, you know, whispers here and there over the years, might in fact exist and might in fact be real. And the convergence of these two totally separate lines of inquiry has now put us right before a demonstrable technology which can literally remove you from the tyranny of the power company, from the tyranny of the Mideast, from the tyranny of any closed, centralized power production and distribution system, and can turn loose an entirely new era in human understanding and physics, science, and looking at life the way maybe we're supposed to be enjoying it. It is fundamental breakthrough stuff, and because I have the platform now, being invited by NASA to present our data again and again and again, this makes the third NASA presentation of the Mars research that they have specifically called us up and invited us to present. I got the idea that it would be kind of neat if I were to provide the missing link between De Palma's research, the so-called N-space machines, N referring to number of spaces, and we'll get into that in a minute, and the theoretical underpinnings of our own Mars decoding of the message at Cydonia. The NASA people I've talked to have agreed to have the engineers who have been interested in these things in the audience on Tuesday afternoon next. The Indian government will unveil one of these devices, a generator. Because we'll call it a generator because if you're producing electricity, it is a generator, right?
Okay, but does it have to turn?
Of course it has to turn.
Yeah.
You know, the magnetic field has to rotate in space.
All right, well, then how do they make it generate? Where do they get the energy to make it turn or do something?
There are several ways of doing it.
Right.
The principle is that if you rotate the magnet in space, you can pull current off, and it apparently comes from nowhere. It does not come from the mechanical rotation of the magnet. It comes from the space through which the magnet is drawing its energy, which goes back to the basic physics of why do magnets have magnetic fields. What is a magnetic field? What is an electron? I mean, we're really down to fundamental basics.
Well, but wait a minute. Help me here. If I were to see this thing they're going to unveil in India, this is?
Hmm?
Okay, and they're going to show this off when now?
Within 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay, and what am I going to see?
You'll see a platform on which sit two end-to-end motor-looking devices connected by a shaft.
Yeah.
On the one end, there is a standard electric motor.
Yeah.
On the other end of the same shaft, there is this device that is called an N-space generator.
Yeah.
Meaning a higher-dimensional space generator.
Yeah.
You turn the motor on, it's attached to, let's say, wall current, all right, or batteries.
Okay.
Turn the motor on, it begins to rotate through the shaft, the magnets in the generator. You then close another switch, and you shunt some of the current generated in the generator back to the magnets in the electric motor.
Okay.
It disconnects the electric motor from the wall, and the thing bootstraps itself forever. It sounds...
Wait a minute. This is the kind of stuff that Joe What's-His-Name has been trying to tell the world about for a long time ago.
Joe What's-His-Name?
From Mississippi. What's his... I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name.
Joe Newman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same principle.
Is that what he's on to?
That's what, the same thing. They're all the same. The problem is some of them are so complicated mechanically that the efficiencies are so low that you almost get nothing out. That's where the individual variation in inventors and mechanical dexterity and, you know, genius come to play. You know, I could give you the specs for designing anything, right?
Wait a minute.
House and two different people will build two different systems. Okay, wait a minute.
But in Joe Newman's device... Once you hook the electric current up and you give it a kick, then it apparently runs by itself.
Right.
Okay. Now my question is, can you take power off of it?
Of course, you take the power off the other end, the generator part. You feed it back around so that it continues to rotate. All right. Because you've got to overcome mechanical friction.
Yeah.
And when you measure input, you're measuring about 5 kilowatts input on this device, I understand, in India.
Yeah.
And they're getting 30 kilowatts out.
Okay, now the 5 kilowatts...
Obviously, in that 30 kilowatts, you can find 5 kilowatts, right? To run the input motor.
Well, I have no problem with that, but my question then...
The question is, where does the energy come from?
Where does it?
The energy come from? In our conventional theories, in our conventional views of physics, this is impossible. This is something from nothing. This is perpetual motion.
Okay.
It's gotten to be the laughing stock of anybody, you know.
Wait a minute. I'm not laughing at all, but we've got to take the half-hour break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this.
But you can't ever hope to get there according to the theories, right?
Okay.
What we found was that those theoretical calculations specifically predicted what we are seeing in the planets and in the sun and all came together in these so-called Sidonia equations left to us in these objects on Mars.
All right, now.
What that means,
right,
if I can finish, that the way these devices work is that by virtue of rotation, by virtue of spin, an object in three-dimensional reality is projected partially into a fourth-dimensional reality, a what's called a force space. And what happens then is that you open a circuit. It's like throwing a switch or opening a window or a door or a gate. And the higher dimension has more energy potential than the lower dimension. And because of the laws of thermodynamics, which work if you open the system to include all the dimensions accessible, the energy falls from the higher to the lower. So in essence, simply opening the doorway to energy waterfall. That's how the devices, we believe now, how they work. It's not perpetual motion. It's basically in a circuit to an infinite source of energy in a higher dimensional state. And there are inventors and corporations in this country who are developing prototypes and marketing them, and one of those key people, Dr. Bruce De Palma, a physicist from Harvard, MIT, taught physics at MIT, has worked 15 years in this very lonely area. He is going to come on your show, and we will have the chance to ask him some very intense questions. When should we...
Dr. Bruce De Palma is on the line with me. Dr. De Palma, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello there. We're going to get Richard Hoagland back with us. He will be connected up in just a moment or two.
Well, of course they do, and the Indians are very profound in their scientific efforts, and right at this moment they have a machine which fulfills 5 kilowatts in, it gives 30 kilowatts out. But this is a development of the Indian government. It's not been publicized in this country for reasons that I can't understand, but maybe this program is a kind of a breakthrough on this level.
Dr. De Palma, who's going to start building these devices, and when are we going to see them in applications around the world?
Well, I have a corporation here in California, the De Palma Energy Corporation, which does build these generators, and I have a 100 kilowatt generator sitting in my garage a few hundred feet away.
Well, now, is it powering your house?
No, it isn't powering my house, because... you've got to understand that the people who've tried to take, well, let's put it this way, the most revolutionary act a person can commit at this present moment, which is totally nonviolent, is to take the electric meter off their house.
Okay.
But if anybody does that and has a non-polluting energy system which runs itself, then it's subject to confiscation by the United States government.
Oh, come on.
Oh, it's happened before, and all the other people who have tried this have become incredibly frightened or have left the country or just won't talk. And my approach to the whole situation is to provide the basic physical experiments so that someone who is a scientist and has some brains can put two and two together and say, my God, this is a great breakthrough. We can go forward with it. The one person that I know of who produced a generator that produced almost 5 to 1 and tried to patent it got gagged by the Department of Defense. This was a man named Adam Trombley, and this happened back...
What do you mean by gagged?
But he was gagged in the sense that he couldn't even tell he was gagged. He sent in his patent application, and when you send your patent application, even before it goes to the patent department, it's reviewed by a committee of the Department of Energy. And if it's of national security interest, then they immediately spring into operation. And so because he provided such in the legal... are what they call bona fides. You bring in lawyers who are electrical engineers who document the readings on the meters and everything, and he produced an airtight case to show that he had made such a machine. And he got a letter from the Secretary of Defense, Brown at the time, Harold Brown, that said this is classified and you can't tell it was classified and you're totally gagged and you can't talk about it. And that happened. And so I have tried to avoid that situation by not producing some machine which could be confiscated from me and somebody could put a gag order on me so I even couldn't tell that it had been confiscated.
They have asked me to come with our team, with several other scientists that are part of the Mars investigation. I've invited Bruce to be part of our contingent to demonstrate both the Mars data, the mathematical, conceptual, hyperdimensional theories and frames, the astrophysical things that we now can see the planets and stars are doing, that are doing this naturally in the universe, leading to Dr. De Palma's devices that do it in the laboratory and can make real technological inroads in a major energy crisis situation. I have asked them to test his devices, and they have agreed in principle. Dr. Larson, who spoke to me an hour and a half the other day, has agreed in principle, and we will see, and we will keep you informed as to how this is progressing.
Two contacts on the rotor and take the electricity directly out of the magnet. These generators can be produced, I would say, at about one-third the cost of present electrical generators for the same amount of power. It's a very, very simple machine to make. The engineering of this thing to go into an automobile is the kind of a thing which takes a lot of applications engineers and people who have to design things to withstand heat.
Well, but let's leave them alone. Let's just simply say that you could hand me one of these units in bigger than a lunchbox, in some kind of a self-venting box, and I could get an electric car that ran on batteries, and I could put this thing in the electric car, and it would sit there and chug away around the clock, keep the batteries up, and charge the batteries as I drove, and I could drive happily ever after.
That's right, for as long as you could drive, with no limits whatsoever.
What about the Indian government? They've got a device now. When are they going to show the world, Bruce?
Well, they'll show the world if you want to send a TV crew to Karwa, the western coast of India. It's south of a place named Goa, which is an old Portuguese colony there. And I could arrange that this crew went in there and videotaped the Indian experiments there, which have all developed out of my work here in California.
Well, I mean, when are they going to be able to turn this thing on and turn on a light bulb?
Right now.
Right now.
They've been working on this for 12 years.
Now, for everybody out there, Phil Klass is a government agent. He has been a government agent for over 20 years. He's paid by the government. We don't know exactly what agency, but he's a professional UFO debunker. So if anybody ever hears him on the radio or television, do not pay any attention, because the man has a profession, and that is debunking UFO, and he has been doing this over 25 years. So don't pay any attention.
Well, how does he explain the concerns of the Belgian Air Force, the European Economic Community, and as recently as September 2nd when Russia explained that their Air Defense Command has been tracking these UFOs, has photographs of them, sees them on radar, sees them in plane-to-plane encounters. One of their planes was bathed in a blue beam of light by one of these craft, and the pilot, the co-pilot, died. One of their cosmonauts openly states he saw a alien. Releases. I have all the releases. They never get reported in the United States. But how does Phil Klass tell that these people are all crazy when Soviet cosmonauts say, we've seen these things come up alongside our Mir spacecraft? What does he say to them?
Well, Phil Klass is a professional debunker. He has an answer for everything. Of course, he wouldn't pay any attention. So that was in Russia. Who knows? All of a sudden, the Russian would go on the bandwagon with UFO, just like America has for the last 25 years. He will explain there's nothing to it, because he's a professional debunker. Of course, you and I know, not only in Russia, right here in the United States, all over Europe, Asia, it doesn't matter where you go, the Air Force of each nation has a counted UFO. All the pilots have seen UFO. There's no question they're out there. And Phil Klass is in a quicksand. He's slowly sinking. Everybody laughs him off in the UFO community. But he will have an answer. I don't know if you ever had him on the radio show, but if you have him on, I mean, he will have an answer. I guarantee you that. But do not pay any attention to Phil Klass. He's a professional UFO debunker. And the hell with him. He's nothing but a nerd. You know, he's a thorn in everybody's eye. But the best thing is to ignore Phil Klass. I think that's the best solution. Ignore Phil Klass, and eventually he will go away.
All right. Thank you.
One more thing. This Wednesday night, Unsolved Mystery will have an update of the English Circles. So everybody watch Unsolved Mystery this Wednesday.
All right, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate it. You bet. You take care. All right. Short break. Maybe Phil Klass should get involved in the Salmonella crisis, the Salmonella epidemic. 9,000 people have died in the United States in one of the most carefully covered up, absolute terrible epidemics that's ever hit the United States of America. And the chicken industry will not allow this information out. We have got a tremendous article coming up in our next magazine.
Richard Hoagland, hello there.
Hello, Chuck.
Yes, you're back.
We are back.
You have been busy. You went to NASA, NASA Lewis in Cleveland last week and gave a presentation. We got 5 minutes before the half hour break. Tell us about it.
Last Tuesday, I was invited by Lynn Bondurant, who is chief of educational programs at NASA Lewis, to present the kind of summation of our work, the Mars research and related items, to a national NASA education conference every year. NASA brings a group of people together from all over the country who interface with the schools, the secondary and primary schools, in the so-called Space Mobile program. And they bring these people together with teachers, with headquarters staff, with various resources to bring them up to speed on new developments in NASA, new projects, new research. And for some reason, they wanted us to present our Mars inquiries, which, of course, are not NASA. They have not been pursued by NASA. They have not been sanctioned by NASA. The planetary science community in NASA has been sort of beside themselves that we've been doing this and discussing it. And yet there we were, standing up in front of a packed auditorium full of teachers and scientists and engineers and educators and contaminating delicate young minds through them, because they're going to fan out all across the country. And afterwards, the Deputy Director of Education for NASA itself, Dr. Anderson from headquarters, whom I have met on previous occasions in other venues, came up and made a very big point of congratulating me, of expressing his interest in our work, of conveying his good wishes. And I'm standing there saying to myself, what is going on?
Well, I'm delighted that your work has been well received as of late. Now, what's going to happen next? Yes. Obviously, somebody is starting to listen. Somebody's starting to say the guy's not crazy. They're going to do a TV show, aren't they?
They are planning a miniseries. I and Carl now both have our own miniseries. They're calling this, Chuck, but it's enough of this, they're calling it Hoagland's Mars. It'll be sent from NASA Lewis this fall up to Westar 6, which is the satellite that they have rented transponder space on.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be downlinked to every PBS station in America that takes the service, and it is going to be in a minimum of three parts. The initial interview done last spring, and the video of the presentation last Tuesday, which I helped edit over 2 days, which will be divided into two parts and aired sometime this fall on a PBS station near you. What I see here is a two-edged sword. On the one hand, yes, they're giving us a platform, and they're giving our work an appropriate hearing, and they're giving it a frame. But they're calling it with a name that I would never in a million years have chosen because of the element of deniability. If it doesn't fly in Peoria, folks, they can always say, well, look, it's Hoagland's Mars. It's not ours. Right?
But they thought enough of it to present it.
I think that's the important thing, and that means that a lot of people who have not been exposed to this stunning evidence will get exposed to it. And what I have always wanted, what all my colleagues, the whole team has wanted, is for this to all get its fair hearing, for everything to be on the table, and then let's, as any good science, find out if it works.
So what we're doing then maybe is warming up society for the next installment of information.
I think so, and it's one heck of a warm-up, because in this presentation, I pulled no punches. I mean, I led with the Mars data, moved through the hyperdimensional geometry and the physics that we think the message of Cydonia is giving us, and then concluded with a very supportive plea to test Dr. De Palma's machines, his devices, to duplicate his experiments, to bring them officially into NASA under the Space Act, where everything should be public domain. And believe me, if they put that all in the air, it's going to make a lot of people think.
We're back. Richard Hoagland is with me. Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, tell us how these circles all interrelate.
Well, as you know, when we interviewed Colin Andrews on this show a few weeks ago,
At that point, I suspected from the stuff I'd heard through the press that the circles, which started out, we got to backtrack a little bit, it started out historically in England. About 1975 is the first modern report that has been reliably tracked down. You have crops, you know, growing in England. You have corn, you have wheat, you have some other crops. And these things began to appear by ones or twos or three in about 1975, according to the best data that they now have. As the 70s progressed, the numbers began to increase a little bit, maybe five or six a year. By the early 80s, they were up to maybe 15 or 20 a year.
Yeah.
By the mid-80s, they had gone up to a staggering 200-300 a year.
Yeah.
This year, they're over 600 a year. In other words, the curve is doubling. Every year, you got twice as many. I mean, next year, who knows what's going to happen? With all these numbers, it's obviously easy now to do statistics, to look at patterns and see how they fall on the real estate in England.
Yep.
What seems to show up, and what struck us immediately, was that they were clustered, not at random, all over England, the British Isles, but they were located in a very specific geometric feature centered on Stonehenge, the ancient megalithic stone monument that has been so mysterious for so many years, with so many theories as to what it was supposed to be, you know, an ancient computer, a druidic temple, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The pattern that the circles, the new ones, formed around the old circle, Stonehenge, according to Andrews, was basically identical. In other words, if you took the circles and you nested them inside Stonehenge, you found that they were even multiples of the geometry in Stonehenge itself. Furthermore, they were even multiples of the geometry of the about 1,000 other stone ring monuments that dot Britain all over the landscape that have been explored over the last, 200-300 years.
Yeah.
No one really knows why these ancient stone circles, which involved a tremendous amount of labor, were created. They're not just circles, by the way. They are ellipses. They are partial circles. The general term now is stone ring monuments. Their identifying hallmark is, according to Alexander Thom, who was a civil engineer at Oxford, who for over 30 years laboriously measured by hand, he and his colleagues, most of these circles, Thom found that they were laid out with one basic unit of measurement, but there seemed to be a kind of a master architect behind them, or at least an architect's rule, if you will. And he called this unit the megalithic yard, and it turned out to be equal to 2.72 British feet. Well, imagine our surprise and astonishment when we discovered that 2.72 is the specific ratio at Sidonia over and over again, which is the key to solving the riddle of the objects on Mars.
Wait a minute. Let's put this where anybody could understand it. What you're saying is, imagine there was a yardstick, and instead of it being a yard long, it's 2.72 feet long.
Yeah, instead of 3 feet, which is our yardstick.
All right.
Imagine this is a yardstick that's slightly shorter, 2.72 feet.
But it's
a standard yardstick.
Okay, and the same yardstick of 2.72 feet was used as the unit of measure for all the stone circles on England, but it's the same unit of measure for the stuff on Mars.
That's right.
That's what you're telling us.
It's the same unit of measure of the new circles in Britain.
So the point we've got is the new circles in Britain, the old stone circles in Britain and England, okay, and the circles and the geometric shapes on the planet Mars, somebody has the same yardstick.
That's what it looks like.
Okay.
Now, we know what the yardstick is trying to tell us, because this 2.72 is not a figure picked out of thin air. It is a extremely relevant, significant, what we call dimensionless constant. In other words, it works in anybody's numbering system, not just the British feet. It turns out, and we talked about this before, that the key to Sidonia, the solution to the puzzle laid out by Sidonia in this geometry, is something called a circumscribed tetrahedron. A tetrahedron is a simple four-sided pyramid. It's the simplest form, geometric regular form you can have. It's got four corners, four points, four sides, Each of the sides is made up of equilateral triangles, each side being equal, each angle being 60 degrees. You find it in any standard geometric textbook, you know, any high school on this planet. You put it in a sphere, you get a very interesting number. You can measure the surface area of this tetrahedron, you know, square inches, square yards, square feet, whatever. You measure the surface area of the sphere you put it in, square inches, square yards, square feet. The ratio between those two is 2.721. The message of Sidonia is that particular number. What's striking now is that same number, in terms of feet, in terms of ratios, is showing up in the ancient circles all over Britain and Europe, in the modern circle counterparts, and apparently, from some of the data we've got, in the other circles distributed around the globe.
All right. Stop right there, if you would. Let me do the half-hour break.
What's wonderfully resonant about their distribution is it forms a huge equilateral triangle with Stonehenge in the center. And an equilateral triangle, all sides equal, 60-degree angles, three of them, is in two dimensions the representation of the tetrahedron in three dimensions. I mean, these guys want us to get it, but get it good. Well,